Christmas to you out there from the Day 2 Cloud podcast. Merry Christmas, Ned.
Merry Christmas, Ethan, and happy holidays to everyone else. We've got a very special episode for our listeners out there, and it's not that kind of very special episode. This is an exciting and fun very special episode. We had the privilege of having a great conversation with Kelsey Hightower. He put out a tweet on Twitter around December 6th asking if anybody would like to chat about Kubernetes and the future of it on their podcast. And we naturally put our hands up, and he was more than nice enough to join us on the podcast. We're going to talk about lots of interesting topics when it comes to Kubernetes. I know we're going to be covering things like networking, security. No, we're not talking about security. Messed that up.
No, we didn't talk about security. We didn't get to that part of the conversation, Ned.
We
only had 45 minutes to chat with Kelsey, but it was an absolutely outstanding conversation. We did cover things like, should you, as an infrastructure engineer, go get a certified Kubernetes administrator rating? Does that make sense or does that not make sense? Will Kubernetes actually be something that you work on, or is it going to kind of fade into the background, like the engine of a car, that you don't really have to worry about it too much? We talk about networking and IPv6, Ned, and we hit other topics too.
Right, Ethan. I think the biggest thing that we talked about that I'm super excited for people to listen to is sort of the operational reality of Kubernetes, and also how, like you mentioned, it gets abstracted, and to a certain degree, Kubernetes might end up disappearing, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense to learn. There's still a place for the mechanics of the world that need to worry about what that car engine is doing. So that is kind of where we left things in the conversation. So I guess without further ado, welcome to the Day 2 Cloud podcast, Kelsey Hightower.
So Kelsey, thank you very much for joining us today. And I mean, I think a lot of people know who you are, right? You got, 8 billion followers on Twitter and so on. So it's not like it's a great mystery to a lot of folks who Kelsey Hightower is. But, just give us a quick background, who you are, and more specifically, your involvement with the Kubernetes project over the last several years.
Yeah, so I guess I kind of bet big early, right? I saw Kubernetes coming maybe 4 or 5 years ago before joining Google, where I currently work in a developer relations organization. And I just started becoming an early contributor. And that's just a checkpoint in my career, right? I'm this open source configuration management person that used to work at Puppet Labs. And before getting into the vendor side of things, right, where I'm either building products in the open source world, I definitely had almost every job in the enterprise space, right? Like I managed switches, routers, worked in data centers, tech support, and managed people. So I'm this well-rounded person who has a lot of empathy for what goes on in the space.
I was going to say heavily scarred person, but well-rounded, that's a nicer way to put it.
Well-rounded is a nicer way of putting that,
Yeah, let's keep it positive, That's great to hear, because Kubernetes does seem so developer-centric at times, and it's great to hear that you've got that background that's more, well, not necessarily more, but has that infrastructure component to it. You understand what a switch is. You know what a router does. So when you're trying to solve those kind of problems, it isn't a totally foreign concept to you. How did you land into the more development space of things, making contributions to Kubernetes?
Yeah, so I think 14, 15 years ago, when I really kind of got deeply into the tech world, I started as this free BSD system administrator, really got deep into the kernels, the command line tools. But eventually all system administrators know that the best way to do things is to probably automate them, right? So you start out with Bash and Python and various tools. And then throughout my career going forward, I just put that in the tool belt. So at that point, you're kind of playing both roles, right? Now, there's points in times in my career where I was a full-time developer, less on the ops side. So when I approached Kubernetes for the very first time, I looked at it with my operations hat on. It's like, wow, this scheduler, the way it thinks about placing things on machines, the fact that nodes are a first-class object and then the scheduler places things there. So my early contributions were with that ops hat on. I was working at CoreOS, and this is a very early period of Kubernetes. There is no authentication. You were assumed to put Nginx in front of it. There was no way to register nodes automatically, so you had to kind of either automate that yourself. So my first set of contributions were building some of those integrations for CoreOS. So ops-minded, taking my development skills and contributing there to make it a better platform operationally.
Right, and like you said, you bet big on Kubernetes, and it seems like that was a well-placed bet. There's a lot of other technologies you could have placed your bet on, and was there something shiny and sparkly about Kubernetes that really grabbed your attention, or was it just the best of what was out there at the time?
programming languages resonate with certain people. Like when you come from Bash, Sed, and Awk, Perl really resonated with you back then. And now when I saw Kubernetes, all of the little components, like the first thing I did with Kubernetes was get it all installed from scratch, right? This is pre-documentation time. But so you're like reverse engineering binaries, putting them together and like, oh my God, look at this system. It's the system I would build if I had 10 years of free time to really focus. And honestly, the experience to know that a system like that should be built. So when I saw it, it was not because it was new and shiny. It because it was extremely pragmatic and did all the things that I thought should have been handled at that layer.
Okay. So I know Kubernetes is what, like it's about 5 years old now. And it's had some growing up to do and still has plenty of growing to do in the future. Where would you say it is now in its maturity life cycle?
Most people would say it's largely done, right? The big concepts of Kubernetes are largely done. I remember when Kubernetes went 1.0 a couple of years back, right? We had this big 1.0 launch at OSCON. And I remember a big part of that launch and building up to it was, what does 1.0 mean and what does core mean? And this is at the time when OpenShift really started to take off. So Red Hat is a big contributor to Kubernetes, but they took a pass to their audience, which is OpenShift, right? So they have this platform as a service in a box. And they came up with a lot of cool concepts like namespaces, the deployment objects that we know about today. There's a lot of features that when we look back, they're not really core. What's core is like a service, a pod, a replica set. These are the base things that you need to build any other platform that you want. So if you look in the Kubernetes API, you'll see things like core, and then you see things like apps. And I think back then is we drew that line and said, this is what core means. And it's been fairly stable ever since, right? The last big addition, I think, to the core was RBAC, because you have to do that in the system. You can't really bolt it on. So I think it's largely done. It's largely stable. And the reason why I can say that is because of the extension interface, whether that's a CRD where you can build your own custom resource type and have your own control loop, make a native-like feature inside of Kubernetes without changing the core.
Right. I think that's key, what you're talking about with the whole core piece. I know one of the other projects that Kubernetes is often compared to is OpenStack. And I think OpenStack had a really big tent kind of feel, like everybody come on in, do your thing. But it was too much. It was too expansive. And it seems like Kubernetes is a little more precise in what is within Kubernetes and then building an ecosystem around that. Has that been your experience?
I will say one thing. One benefit Kubernetes had was it assumed that IaaS would be there already. Right. So whether that's a cloud provider, whether that's OpenStack or VMware, we assume that you would already have APIs for creating nodes, attaching block devices, and creating load balancers. So what Kubernetes did was be very opinionated and said, look, that's the new world that we're in. OpenStack came out of a world of chaos where there's just a bunch of bare metal. You know, cloud is just getting kicked off, so there's really no other blueprints or templates to look to. Whereas where Kubernetes comes out and says, okay, what's missing from IaaS? And then you add this abstraction that says, we already have Docker. Let's not reinvent that layer. And you tie these all together. And I think that's why it was so successful. And it was almost in many ways, it felt so obvious to people.
Right, right. Some of the pieces, key pieces were already there. And it was just, like you said, let's assume that cloud already exists and IaaS exists. And how can we just bolt onto that and use those features, but abstract it enough so it's not specific to GKE or to AWS, but something that is at a higher level in the stack, as it were.
And for your listeners, one major component that we don't ever really talk about in the Kubernetes world, there's a component called the cloud provider. It's a separate binary that handles all of the glue. And the way it works these days is we've moved the cloud providers out of the core repo. So Amazon, Azure, VMware, everyone has to maintain their own cloud provider piece. So what that means is when you say, here, Kubernetes, create this volume for me, it then delegates out to the cloud provider binary. And then you have to do the work of creating your EBS volume or creating your block device or attaching it to some IP address on the node. You have to do all of that work yourself. So that big piece means that without the IaaS interface, Kubernetes would be really, really hard to pull off.
Right. And it's great to see that you moved that out of the core executable and it's kind of its own component now, because it seems like then you can iterate faster on the core and not worry about keeping pace with the cloud providers, and they can iterate as they go. So you've decoupled that dependency, as it were. Very cool.
So what would you say, Kelsey, for folks that are thinking, well, I'm not sure that I want to deploy all of my apps up in the cloud, or maybe I'm going to do it myself on bare metal because of there's a number of reasons why you might want to do that. But they just heard you say, yeah, we kind of assumed, you know, public cloud is how you're consuming this. IaaS is a, well, you didn't say prerequisite, but you know, kind of implied it.
A lot of people on-prem have the equivalent of some form of IaaS, right? Like if you got VMware, you have the vSphere API. Mm-hmm. If you got a Cisco Juniper switch, and I spent a lot of time in those days, they have a pretty decent API as well. You can create VLANs and all these things on the fly. So to me, you just have kind of a bespoke set of APIs that represents your IaaS, and maybe not a uniform layer that you find in the cloud. The nice thing about that is Kubernetes provides that uniform API on top, and then you can go and mux things in that cloud provider binary. So one of the first contributions I did for CoreOS, I built a cloud provider type integration for CoreOS. The way we do nodes is different. The way we think about creating a load balancer is different than you do in the cloud. So that kind of gives you that place to say, hey, my on-premise has a collection of APIs. The cloud provider interface is where I glue them together, and then I can just use Kubernetes like everyone else.
Mm. So you said Kubernetes is largely done, but I feel like there's still a lot of things it could do. So what are some big future advancements you're sort of thinking of in the world of Kubernetes? Is it within the core itself? Is it this more peripheral other things attaching into it?
Yeah, so I would probably say like Linux is largely done for the most part, right? There's core systems that change, but they can't break user mm-hmm. land. So you can't have a radical change. We can't go and change all the system calls. Mm-hmm. And new system calls take years to get adopted because of the rollout pattern with like enterprise support and so forth. So when you start to really think about why is Kubernetes done is that the core provides enough for us to do everything else we need, right? We have this API server that has a really great set of interfaces for extensions, CRDs, custom resource definitions. Mm-hmm. So once you have that, we have a place to store things. We have a place to do access control with RBAC. So now what you're starting to see is people building new platforms. I have this saying, lots of people say it now as well. Kubernetes is a platform for building platforms. So now what you're going to start to see, just like we saw in the Linux world, Linux underpins Android, but most Android users don't talk about Linux, right? It starts to hide itself underneath the next platform. So I think that's where all the innovation is coming. If you're a service mesh, you're Istio, you're building on top of Kubernetes. If you're a workflow engine like Argo, you're building on top of Kubernetes. And lastly, what you see in the machine learning world, like Kubeflow, they're basically building on top of Kubernetes, assuming that there's this distributed system that's one level up above IaaS. And that's where you're starting to see a lot of the innovation take place.
Well, what should an infrastructure engineer do to learn Kubernetes then, or should they? Because what you're saying is, if it's quote unquote done, and I could argue with the release notes and all the alpha features that show up in different release notes that, I mean, it doesn't feel done kind of, but I get your point. You know, the core functionality is there, the providers are there that need to be there. And now we're going to build platforms on top of that. So let's say I'm an infrastructure engineer, should I go become a certified Kubernetes administrator? Does that make sense? Or we kind of see it fade where it doesn't matter if I know those innards or not?
This is a great question. And I just thought of an analogy just now is that think about the freeway system in the United States of America. It's largely done. If you want to go add a new freeway, it's a monumental effort at this point. Mm-hmm. So most people who drive cars, I get on I-5, 205. We just kind of know that the infrastructure is relatively done from the mindset of the person driving the car. But there are tons of people who are adding access ramps all the time, fixing bridges, repaving, updating the lines, adding toll roads. There's going to always be room to, you know, improve what we have. So if you are a person who works on the road, of course, you need to go learn Kubernetes because it's part of the infrastructure stack. Right now, you're probably building something like Kubernetes if you squint at it, mm-hmm. right? If you have a bunch of shell scripts, if you got Puppet Chef for Ansible and you're using playbooks and inventory files, well, that's you trying to schedule your workloads ahead of time. Kubernetes just has a different component for that. So just look at it as a mild evolution to what you're already doing. Why not learn that and put it in your tool belt? So if you're an infrastructure expert, that's your level. Number one, Kubernetes still breaks. We're going to always have a job. It's not like this thing is the perfect software that once you install it, there's nothing to do. No, once you install it, now you have a lot more to do which is babysit, tune, performance tunes, fix, and report bugs. It's just a different type of job we get to engage in.
In other words, there is value there in understanding the CKA program. It's not a, you know, for a while Kubernetes is still, you know, being deployed, okay, it's not like it's ever going to be so hidden that there's just no point in knowing it. There's going to be value there. And so for people that are on a career path in infrastructure and want to learn Kubernetes, that's a worthwhile endeavor that's going to carry them forward.
Oh, yeah. People will pay you to hide it. See, that's the key. Like, we pay plumbers to hide it. We pay electricians to hide it in the wall so my light switch works. Now, here's the thing. If my light switch isn't working, I'm calling a certified electrician, right? So that's where it will always be an industry for these things. And I think once you start talking about hiding things, then when they don't work, you put a lot more value on the person who's supposed to hide it.
Right. Especially, I love the plumber analogy, because if something's going wrong with my plumbing, I am not touching that. Because if something goes wrong with water, it goes really, really wrong with water.
And good plumbers make a decent amount of money. So absolutely. I think a lot of people forget that particular skill set. And you know what? And as things start to spread, everyone almost has a toilet in the United States. So it's one of these places where as Kubernetes starts to grow, your value will definitely continue to increase. And I think that's why it's worth that long-term investment now.
Right. And there's definitely a conversation to have around training and certification and how, say, a plumber handles becoming a certified plumber. There's an apprenticeship and then probably a journeyman program, and then you become a master and then you train a new apprentice. We don't have that sort of formal educational process within tech. And I've heard people make arguments that we should. Don Jones has a whole book that's all about being the master and taking people under your wing and having some kind of apprenticeship, though not formal. Do you feel like that's maybe something that's missing just in general or specific to Kubernetes?
I understand the sentiment, but I think there's definitely a chance that you can result in gatekeeping. See, one of the nice things about our field is that you can jump in and experiment with your own laptop. You can go and get access to all of this technology without a license. You're allowed to create without a license or credentials. And this is why we see a lot of people like myself. I don't have a college degree. I don't have what people will consider the formal training. I have the thing where I kind of bootstrap myself. And yeah, I think I've learned on the job. And then to his point, I do think it would be valuable to have more of a formal onboarding process at some of these companies where we take these fundamentals and we're patient with people. You know, this is why people like me write books or tutorials like Kubernetes the Hard Way. I want to show people how the fundamentals fit together. And then there are some people that are building courses on those, but it would be nice to start to have some formalized way to onboard new people.
Right. Huh. That's definitely food for thought. To get back to an earlier point where we were talking about, you know, the guts of Kubernetes and things that need to grow and change a little bit. I think before we started recording, I had mentioned networking and your eyes lit up that networking is something that is definitely an area that needs to mature. And I know that was kind of a theme at KubeCon in San Diego this year was things like connectivity, networking, and storage. So what sort of aspects of Kubernetes networking have changed recently, and what still needs to be done there?
All right, so my stance has always been, especially once I think I kind of learned how Kubernetes worked, Kubernetes really has no opinion about networking when you think about it. By default, you can run a container and say, Kubernetes, get out of the way. I just want to do host networking. Then you're back to the world you know. So if you have 50 interfaces on a VM or a bare metal machine, you can totally say, Kubernetes, I don't want your service discovery. I don't want you to do anything with CNI, this container networking interface. Just give me access to the host network and I'll bind to interface number 22 on my own. And if that's using IPVLAN, who cares? It's all going to work. That is definitely the case. Now, if you want some isolation there, then Kubernetes has a default, what I call a default service mesh, right? And default service mesh in Kubernetes would be IP tables. We have a thing called kubeproxy that says when you deploy an application and you attach a service to it, it will then go and update IP tables with a VIP that only works within the cluster. It'll intercept that VIP and then attempt to round robin between a collection of containers that you say are part of that service group. So that's a very elementary service mesh, kind of give you some guidance on how to find things within the cluster. But that's just kind of a default out of the box. Let's say you want to use console. Hey, you can bring in console just like you did in your bare metal or virtual environment and say, I want to use console to be the authority for service discovery. But guess what? Kubernetes makes your world a little bit easier because since it knows about all the containers and pods running in the cluster, then Consul, which HashiCorp has recently added native Kubernetes support, you can say, hey, Consul, go get the list of things from Kubernetes, and then I'll ask you, console.local, where things are. So it's just one of these things that Kubernetes just provides a really clean integration environment to link in anything that you have. And the last example I'll give you is once you have all these containers kind of with their own IP space, if you think of those IPs as first class, so I work at Google Cloud, and we have this concept called IP aliases. This is where we pull IPs from the VPC, and they have equal footing that the VMs have. Same range, same subnet. Now, once you have a set of first-class IPs that are ratable, maybe through the same L3 control plane, I can take those IPs and manually add them or automate the addition and removal from a load balancer. So you're right back into the world that you know. So I think people kind of overcomplicate things because there's so many ways you could do it. There's no one way you can do it. Right. But isn't that networking?
Well, ouch, Ethan.
I mean, you know, as far as overcomplicating things, there's always that possibility with any technology, and networking, you know, for sure you have that. And what network engineers tend to default to is a standard template. Now, it may be a personal template, you know, whereas this is something I'm familiar with. I know how to do it this way and this works. It's reliable. I know how to troubleshoot it and monitor it and so on. When you introduce the ephemeral world that very often Kubernetes is applied to, there's containers coming and going. They're not always stateful. They were never intended to be stateful back in the beginning. That's been bolted on later. You end up in a different sort of a world where, like you were saying, you could stitch it all together manually if you wanted and you know, and not rely on service discovery. And my brain's going, yeah, but when I'm deploying an application that really wants to be scheduled and orchestrated, that kind of implies there's things changing and coming and going a lot. And I need service discovery. I need that to work reliably and, you know, and all of that. So understanding that is kind of key. You know, and so the networking functionality comes down to, you know, in my mind too, it just feels complex because there are a number of proxies involved and there is, you know, the security mechanisms, how we're going with it from traditional infrastructure aren't always the same. And, you know, is that overcomplicated? I mean, it kind of feels necessary. In other words, you need an infrastructure that can support the ephemeral nature of what's going on with the security needs that are going on. And it has to all be automated because no human could do otherwise. So I don't see that we have a choice other than what I would say is a more typical deployment to be somewhat complicated. Am I wrong in thinking that, Kelsey?
No, I think you're right. So I think when I looked at Kubernetes networking model after spending some time in the networking space, the holy grail in networking was like, if you can get to L3, then it's a little easier to kind of deal with your layouts, right? Like I give this subnet to this range over here. I give this subnet over here. And then I just route everything at L3. And if I can route everything at L3, then I can use some advanced firewalls. I don't have to worry about so much of the broadcast domain with L2, my VLAN setups. Things get a little easier for me if I can just leverage this L3 world. Kubernetes starts with that assumption. You can carve out your subnets to each node, and now you're in this pure L3 world. Now, we all know that firewalls are a good, you know, security mechanism at a layer. Kubernetes says, you know what I'll do? I'll actually automate your security policies at the firewall level if you just tell me these apps have these labels, what would you like to happen? And I'll just do that for you automatically. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the part where Kubernetes says, you know what? Service discovery, we use DNS for a lot of quote-unquote service discovery. Kubernetes says, you know what? If you drop in a plugin, external DNS, I'll update your DNS service for you. So yeah, you're right. Everything is coming and going, but now I have clean APIs that I can now just say, hey, even though things are coming and going, just tell me the way you do things expressed in the form of a policy, and I'll just automate them. To me, that's like the network dream come true.
So I think the complexity isn't in the packet flows as much as it is in the change to how configuration is being done. So for a network engineer that's tight-fisted and loves to, you know, write every configuration line and configure every VIP, and maybe they've gotten so far as to automate some of that, you know, with APIs that are running against the network infrastructure, the Kubernetes model of just, this is all just happening. This is all part of an application deployment that's and the network infrastructure being deployed in the background is intimidating to some folks, and it feels complex. Even though when you look at the end result, it looks awfully familiar. It really, you know, we're all used to proxies. We're all used to load balancers. We're, you know, these are normal things. Packet filtering, access lists. Yeah, there's products out there in the networking space for micro-segmentation that do a very narrowly scoped thing compared to when you look at Kubernetes, what it can do more broadly.
Now, these same engineers are using Vim. And Vim is complex as hell. Right? They're writing bash script, sed, and awk scripts. Like, mm-hmm. These things are complex as hell. I think it's just, they're not familiar.
It is.
When you see Kubernetes, it's just not familiar. Yeah. So you're like, for example, when I went from like DHCP to L3 routing, my mind was blown. It took me a while, right? DHCP, you come up, you get an IP, that's it, that's yours. Then someone's like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to allocate this subnet and we're going to do some IPAM to allocate these blocks. And I'm like, whoa. That sounds way more complex, but think back, DHCP is complex as hell. ARP tables, broadcast domains, it's a nightmare. So I think it's just about being familiar.
It's always amazing that networking works at all, or that that technology works at all. Every time I look at it, I'm like, that's just a miracle that, you know, I push a button and I get the thing that I want. That's preposterous. The thing I'll say about scripting, and especially some of those older bash scripts, is they're very fragile in the sense that there may not be error checking built in. It doesn't have an idea of running with intent. You can't use declarative syntax. It's all just purely imperative. So that can make it very fragile to update and make changes to. But you know, when I first sat down in front of my very first Linux terminal, the guy I was sitting next to was like, all right, so we're going to fire up VI. And I was like, I don't know what that is. He's like, okay, let's fire it up. And I'm going to take you through the tutorial. And he fired up the tutorial. And he's like, I'll be back in 2 hours. Good luck.
Yeah, and I think when I got my first taste of declarative, and I'm not sure it's the same declarative that Kubernetes talks about, is when I was introduced to the way Juniper does things. Like, you would update this running config, you could print it out, and then you could diff it, and then you could apply it. And it felt very declarative versus running a bunch of like iOS commands for the Cisco folks, right? It just felt different. And then I can check in those Juniper way of doing it, TFTP boot a switch with one of them. And that's where I was like, wow, this declarative thing feels different than just running a bunch of commands, hoping I get them right in the right order.
I had the very same experience with Juniper because I've been working on Cisco firewalls and some other Cisco gear. And then we got a Juniper device in and I was like, oh, well, this is completely different and I kind of love it. And yeah, I haven't looked back since on the declarative front.
Talk to me about V6 for a minute, Kelsey, because that was a recent addition. We've got dual SAC support now in 1.16, if my memory of the release notes is correct. That's awfully late to the party. What all happened? Why initially did we not have IPv6 support, and now 5 years on, we do?
So I think it lies in the origin of Kubernetes. Remember, Kubernetes assumes IaaS. Mm-hmm. So if you think about most cloud providers, they didn't allow multicast. They didn't allow IPv6 at their local instance layers, right? Mm-hmm. That was very late in the game because, you know, with the whole VPC model and the way they handle routing, it just, there wasn't an urgent need for IPv6. And to be honest, most enterprise customers are scared of IPv6.
They still are.
Right? All right. So nothing's changed on that front.
Not changed.
So it was never really a priority. I think Docker had support a little earlier on. We just never plumbed it through into the Kubernetes world. And since there were really no good IPAM implementations in the cloud, normally you're just pulling IPs from your VPC. So until we started seeing a little bit more priority there and actually having someone step up to do the work who actually had that priority and expertise, I think that's why you saw it kind of land a little late. And plus, when you do network changes throughout Kubernetes, you got to go and touch everything. Yeah. That means the pod spec. That means the way it's stored in etcd, the programming languages that need to read that IP address, because you know not all programming languages handle IP addresses, IPv6 addresses appropriately, especially when you start to see people packing IPv4 addresses in IPv6 space. So I think we just had to make sure that end-to-end, the whole system would work. Because what do you do in the cloud when a pod only has an IPv6 address, but the load balancer in the cloud doesn't support IPv6 backends? Is it all broken now? So you got to do all those checks and balances to make sure it's an end-to-end experience.
No. Yeah, and kind of have to wait for the cloud providers to support IPv6 on their internal VPCs or VNets or whatever it is. Because I think up until recently, Azure didn't have it in VNets until maybe this year. I'm not sure when AWS finally introduced it. That was pretty recent. So yeah, there's a lot of work to do there.
Now, what are the limitations of the V6 implementation in Kubernetes as it stands? Are there any notable caveats?
No, because you know a lot of the, so when we talk about the container networking interface, CNI for short, it's all about the kernel, right? So when you launch a pod, the way the CNI interface typically works is you hand off control to some plugin on the machine. And part of that interface is IPAM. So you can do whatever you want. So now that you have the network namespace, yep, you can IP the interface, the virtual interface there, and then you hand it back to Kube. So when Kube sees the IP, it then adds it to the, you know, the pod spec that goes back upstream to say, hey, this thing lives at this IP. So that's just going to work just like you would expect it to work on a Linux box. Now, does the rest of the system understand it? Kube DNS needs to register an IPv6. And this is why we push for dual stack, because most people are going to assume IPv4, right? Yeah. By default in most of these implementations. So this is why we push for that dual stack. This is why dual stack was kind of key to making IPv6 realistic in the current world.
Mm-hmm. Long-term support, Kelsey. So there's, you said Cates is done, right? You've made that assertion that basically the core is done. All right. Does that mean we, you know, the rapid iteration, some of the stability challenges and so on, maybe could fade, because I want to go to like a maintenance release of Kubernetes where I've got long-term support on this thing. Is that on the horizon?
Yeah. So I think Red Hat's been doing a good job with that. Google Cloud, we just released this idea of channels. So like in the Chromebook world, you have Canary channel, Dev channel, and Stable. So our Stable channel tries to lock you in and like, you know, look, 1.16 with security patches is great. Maybe you hold off on 1.17 until you get a chance to validate that version for your needs. And we have a lot of customers that don't really need any new features. So they want to kind of lock in to a specific version of the API. Now we got to be careful because the API compatibility promise in Kubernetes is like one or two versions back, meaning we want most of the components to be able to understand a Kubernetes config file one or two releases back. So we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves where things don't work. And this is why having core V1 well-defined and getting those base components up to a V1 level so we can have that forward and backwards compatibility was so key. So I think now it's going to be like the Linux distro game. You work with your provider of choice, whether that's Canonical, Red Hat, Azure, Amazon, and they're going to give you something that they can support and give you some long-term guarantees on.
It's a little bit different in the sense that Kubernetes is not owned by a single vendor. So there is no single vendor to provide the LTS support for that specific version of Kubernetes. But if you think of it in terms of a Linux and someone creates a distribution out of that Kubernetes version, whether it's Azure, AWS, now they're providing that sort of LTS support.
The truth is almost every Kubernetes install in the world today is a distro. Mm-hmm. What you see in Google Cloud, because of that cloud provider component, is almost like the user land for Kubernetes. It's that same component is going to be different for Azure. The way they integrate IAM is going to be different. On-prem and what VMware is now doing, all of those are essentially distros. You take as many of the open source components as you can. You layer in the things that you need to make it all work and integrate. That is now your distribution of Kubernetes.
Mm. Another theme that came up a lot in some of the talks that I saw and on the vendor floor was the idea of multi-cluster management. As people really do start to adopt Kubernetes at scale, they've got multiple production clusters in different locations. What do you think the story is around multi-cluster management and what needs to happen there?
The key is you have to think outside of the cluster if you want a chance at this.
Okay.
That's just where you got to start. So just like think about a single server. How do you do multi-server management? You have to think above the server. So then Kubernetes sits above the server and it aggregates multiple servers and then you put interfaces on top and then you just trust those interfaces. So when Kubernetes runs, it says, hey, run this pod and we trust that the local Docker and kubelet will take that pod spec and do all the right things and give us information back that then we centralize so that the mm-hmm. other components can work. Now, let's say you want to manage multiple clusters. The approach people have been taking is going into one of the clusters, making it special, and teaching it how to manage the other clusters. That's not going to work. What you want is something that sits above all of the clusters, just like we do with above all of the machines. So if you have something above all of the clusters, then you can easily say, look, I need a deployment that runs in three clusters. And every time I show someone this, I step back like David Copperfield and I reveal the magic trick. And I say, cat deploy.sh. And then they stare at this for loop. For cluster in clusters, kubectl apply. And then the deployment runs into three different clusters. And guess what? My aggregator that sits on the top says, give me the information about the state of those deployments. That thing at the top, that's kind of your multi-cluster controller. Then it all just makes sense. You just need a different tool. Now, I think people get hung up in the idea that they really, really like the way Kubernetes APIs are declarative. They like this idea of leveraging a Kubernetes-like control plane to handle some of these needs. Well, in that case, you have to kind of suspend belief a little bit and create a admin cluster, if you will, and treat it as a control plane component, not a member of the compute farm. If you do that, then all of this starts to make a little bit more sense. And then it's the equivalent of a bash for loop using the Kubernetes API instead.
Yeah, you tried describing a process that's very simple there. You're saying basically do this for as many clusters as you're trying to deploy this app across. And then basically you're aggregating the information up at a high level. It's not like there's a master brain or like in the world of software-defined networking, you'd have a federated controller that's like a controller of controllers, pushing instructions or policy downstream to other controllers. You're describing something that's much more straightforward, really.
No, so it can be much more straightforward. So maybe we do start with like the bash for loops. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to progress into configuration management. And then we're going to progress into these control planes like we saw in the normal world with like compute. And just the way you describe networking is where we're going to arrive.
Okay.
Right? Because the way I do look at it is exactly how these network controllers work. You define your policy up here, and then you push those things down to be enforced at the edge of the network where the packets actually are flowing. That's what we want.
Okay. So yeah, I always make the analogy back to VMware because I did VMware for many, many years. And so that's where my brain goes when I think about virtualization and abstraction layers, right? And so I think of, you have ESX and then you have the vCenter server. And for a long time, people didn't want to run the vCenter server on the ESX cluster because are you crazy? What happens? It's inception, right? And then people got real comfortable with that. And now like virtual appliance is the way to deploy vCenter. So it sounds like to me, if you're going to approach multi-cluster management, maybe you do have multiple instances of your master controller in a couple different clusters for redundancy's sake, but it could run inside the Kubernetes cluster itself.
Yeah, separate the idea from the implementation detail. So the idea is you need a central control plane that has the ability to reach out to the other control planes. You could run that on a VM, you could run that on a laptop, or you can run that in one of the clusters. Now, the caveat there, though, is if I run it in one cluster and you don't have any migration tools that will spin it up in another cluster should that fail, now you just kind of have your control plane kind of on this island that it shouldn't be on, right?
Right.
Just like load balancers, we put them outside of the blast radius on purpose. So that way, if one of the data centers I'm load balancing to goes down, you don't want the load balancer to go with it. Like, who designed that? So here's the thing. It's the same fundamentals that we already know. It's just more of a mapping exercise to say, how should we do what we know in the Kubernetes world?
Right. A word that you said a little bit earlier was edge. And I just wanted to pick your brain a little bit about the idea of Kubernetes at the edge, because I've heard a bunch of people talking about how the platform of choice for edge deployments, so like edge data centers, those tiny data centers inside cell towers and stuff, will be some version of Kubernetes. And there's been some pushback saying, well, that's too much complexity at the edge. What are your thoughts regarding that?
I heard the same thing said to Juniper when they put FreeBSD on their network boxes. Right? You log into a Juniper box and it's FreeBSD, and they inherited the package system. They had all of this extra stuff, and people was like, whoa, that's way too heavy. You should be running something in hardware, some very basic thing. The problem is, once these switches got bigger and more powerful and had more RAM, right? You got 2-4 gigs of RAM on a switch, and it's not 100% for the data plane. And you have a little bit of that space for the control plane. Once we had things like FreeBSD, it was easy to add extensions, new network services to this thing. So if you think about what's happening to these control towers and quote unquote the edge, these slams are getting bigger. These pops are getting bigger. So now that you have this much extra compute, you don't have to constrain yourself as much to these very small interfaces. So now we can deliver control plane components. I'm not necessarily saying data plane components, but control plane components, I can deliver as a container now. I can still write that in C and C++ if I want some efficiency, but I can now deploy it using the same API. And I'm saying API very clear here because the implementation doesn't have to be the same. So if you think about K3S by the Rancher folks, they've collapsed Kubernetes down to a single binary. They got rid of etcd and have SQLite instead. And the footprint is down to 40 megs of RAM. So in that case, they're designing themselves to run on more of an edge device where maybe you don't handle redundancy in the cluster software itself. Maybe you do it in a slightly different way. So I think we have to make sure that that's what people are aiming towards. So think back, if you're in the networking world, putting FreeBSD on a switch changed the game. I think Linux followed for the Cisco folks. Yep. Imagine now if we can put this Kubernetes-like interface at the edge.
Mm-hmm.
So Ned, you're gobsmacked. Does that floor you?
No. I'm just, my brain is churning through a lot of things. So well done. I think the thing I'm mostly thinking about is the way that it's not about the implementation. And you know, as an infrastructure person and someone who likes installing the fiddly bits and doing things the hard way the first time to see how it actually works, like my mind goes to implementation right away. And that's a dangerous corridor to run down when what I should actually be thinking about is more the higher level. I want to interact with the API. It doesn't necessarily matter how it's implemented underneath that, as long as it does what I want consistently.
So we asked this question earlier, right? What's the role of infrastructure folks in the world of Kubernetes? Mm-hmm. Your role will be, since you have domain knowledge about this area, you may go and change the way Kubernetes works, right? You may say, I don't want Docker as my runtime. We do something different in the telco world. And you can actually use the container runtime interface to bring something more appropriate to your stack. And that job is going to be there forever. That's where we start to get into the details.
Right. So yeah, getting away... Starting with the high level thing and then think about implementation is I just need to make sure my brain goes that way. So it wants to jump right in, right? I think we're getting close to time, but I want to kind of see if there's any additional thoughts that you have in regards to the future of Kubernetes. I know you put this tweet out that you wanted to talk about what the future looks like. And I think we hit on a bunch of great points, but I wanted to see if there's anything that we didn't touch on yet that you think is super important that listeners should know about.
And I think what was unique about today was the people who will make this future come true are the people that are listening right now, right? I'm pretty sure your target audience are the people that will help this future that I describe happen. Kubernetes has to disappear. Kubernetes needs to be more like the internet than like the top of rack switch, right? When you buy a switch, you just see the ports. You start thinking VLANs. You look on the side of the box and you see what protocols it support, what its overall bandwidth is. And we just get into this nitty gritty detail. And sometimes just looking at a top of rack switch, you can't see how that fits into the rest of the internet because you just don't know how the rest of it works. Kubernetes is like that for most people. They're staring at a switch and saying, this is too complex. Once Kubernetes disappears and we start to think of it like the internet, that's like, oh, of course I know how to get online. I open my browser and I type into the search box and things come up. That's a very naive way to think about the internet, but that's why billions of people can use it.
Right.
So the future of Kubernetes is it has to disappear in that way. I'm not saying it's irrelevant, not important. I'm saying is in order to make it accessible, we need the network engineers, we need the operations folks, SREs, we need everyone to understand the goal isn't just to go give the world kubectl.
Right.
That's not the end game. The end game is just to say this thing underneath will allow me to build all these other platforms and you won't even know Kubernetes is there.
Right. We don't need the world running Konfetti. We need the world just consuming Kubernetes and not even knowing. Wow. I love it.
Kelsey, just any other future thoughts before we hit the wrap on today's Day 2 Cloud episode?
I want people to realize that they probably know 85% about what's going on and what needs to happen. It's just a mapping exercise, right? Kubernetes is not a radical change. It's just a different way of doing it. And if you give yourself enough credit, this whole thing gets a lot easier to do that mental mapping.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. I'm finding service meshes to be that. It sounds obtuse. I've heard a lot of people describe it poorly, which I think is maybe confused folks on what it is and so on. So, the more I dive into these things, I agree. It is mapping. It's taking the fundamentals, the tool building blocks that we are all familiar with from IT work over the years, and just applying it into a tool that has systematized a lot of it in a very particular way. And once you get it and get your head around it, it becomes easier. Now, I'm not saying it's easy for me yet because I'm still, my Kubernetes journey is beginning here, Kelsey. Like, I'm looking at the Certified Kubernetes Administrator program as a way to get through, walk down the learning path, if you will. I've been looking at your the hard way, sitting out there in GitHub. I've already got a server sitting in waiting for me. If I can translate GCP into some bare metal, which would be my preferred learning path, we'll see if I can work that out or not. Or maybe I'll just give it in and give you nice people at Google some of my money and do it the GCP way. We're on video with Kelsey here, and you can't see him, but he just made that motion with his fingers, indicates money. Yeah, absolutely.
Gotta make it rain, baby.
And as you say, once you take what you know and apply it to this brand new way of doing it, it gets easier. So that's really encouraging that you put it that way. Now, Kelsey, you're, again, fairly well known on the internet, but for folks that are new to the world of Kelsey Hightower, how can they follow you?
Twitter. My DMs are open. I like to meet new people, do one-on-ones, answer as many questions as I can, but Twitter's where you find me.
Well, thanks for spending time with us today.
You're a brave man.
And you are a brave man. You were brave for raising that tweet. I guess you told us before the show you've already done, five or six different podcast recordings just because you tweeted and said, hey, I'm willing to talk about the future of Kubernetes. So hey, here you are. And thanks for joining us on Day 2 Cloud, Kelsey. We really appreciate it. And a crisp virtual high five to you out there for tuning in if you're listening. And if you have suggestions for future shows, you want us to talk more Kubernetes, you got some Kubernetes stories of your own or just cloud stuff, hey, we want to hear them. Hit either of us up on Twitter. I'm at EC Banks. Ned is at Ned1313. Or, of course, the Day 2 Cloud Show Twitter handle is out there, too. Ned's even got a fancy form in his web, nedinthecloud.com. If you like engineering shows like this one, visit packetpushers.net/subscribe. All of our podcast newsletters, our websites are there. It's all nerdy content designed for your professional career development. And until then, just remember that cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.